You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 21st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the show, the great Cliff Schechter will be joining us. We may also have a special guest. In the member section, we'll also be talking to that other guy from that movie place. Our songs of the week and more, ladies and gentlemen. We nearly didn't make it because of our internet connection today. But yes, we are going to be live. In fact, we are live right now, and of course, you know what that means. That means that it's time for Mr. Cliff Schechter to join us as soon as we play his theme song, coming up in just this moment. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is Cliff Schechter from Libertas LLC. Cliff, welcome.
Samuel, how are you?
I am doing great. Well, let me get your.
I have to tell you, I miss you a bit.
Oh yes, I know. We have spent so much time in person together over the past couple of weeks, haven't we?
We were in Washington at a conference together, in Vegas at a conference together. I mean, if you hadn't been off, you know, losing, you know, your daughter's education money, gambling, we probably would have been together even more. But you know, I kid Sam because I love. It was lots of fun.
No, you don't kid. I did. I bet her $529 fund for this month and next month and the months to come. But you know what? Look, if she can't get an athletic scholarship, then maybe she just doesn't deserve to go to college.
Well, or she could always just go and work on Wall Street, which apparently takes no smarts and allows you to make money for really doing nothing but destroying the economy. So she could do that pretty easily.
Exactly.
You don't have to really prepare her for
exactly.
That.
Hold on. We're going to turn down your high end a little bit. Just going to play a little bit with your sound. It's interesting that you bring up my child, Cliff, because before we want to go anywhere, you know, down at Occupy Wall Street tonight, their parents are bringing their children down there, and it made me contemplate my own parents and everything they did for me. And I just want to take this moment, and you'll have to forgive me, Cliff, because, you know, it's Casual Friday. I'm going to break format a little bit. I just want to take this opportunity to thank my parents for the opportunity I have to do this show, to basically do everything, because – back in 1967, we moved to Worcester, Massachusetts, I guess it was 67, 68, to escape the pogroms that were taking place in Russia at the time. The Tsar was targeting Jewish families, and my parents moved me to Worcester, Massachusetts to make sure that I had the opportunity that was not available to them, and so they left their shtetl. and moved us safely, all of us, to Worcester, Massachusetts. I just need to take that opportunity.
You know what I find amazing about that story, Sam?
What's that?
First of all, obviously, that your family, before they left, were still able to fill out most of the extra roles in Fiddler on the Roof, and they did a great job.
That's right, actually, yes. Shortly thereafter, I believe there was a play. Maybe it was before or after we moved, but based on...
The other thing... Oh, yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
No, please.
Well, I was saying, also, I find it impressive that, it took them about 60 years to get here.
60 years? No, I don't think so. They were actually coming from New York. it would have taken probably about 3.5 hours at that time.
Would they have a time machine where they were able to go forward from when the pogroms were actually taking place in the shtetl, you know, or in 1905 or so? Or
wait a second. Am I... The shtetl, the pogroms took place in 1905. I'm sorry. I misspoke. Look, I don't walk around, Cliff, with documents in my hand as to when the pogroms took place. I think they were escaping the Nazis. My parents were escaping the Nazis in 1967 or 68, somewhere. I don't know when it was. Probably 68. I think it was actually 68. Let me correct myself. I'm not lying about anything. I'm just saying in 1968 is when they came escaping the Nazis. I think Kristallnacht happened, and we moved to Worcester, Massachusetts.
Again, Sam, the genius that you are, and that 1 year of law school I know did do you a hell of a lot of good. A little bit off in the time, you know, 45, 44, or 67, you know, it would have been a 23-year or so, 22-year journey for your parents.
I think you'll find that Kristallnacht actually happened earlier than that. I think it was closer to, I think it was like in 39. Was Kristallnacht.
Honestly, I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. But I thought you just meant the general atmosphere of World War II.
You know what it was?
I even screwed up my joke, Sam, because of my ignorance.
Let me just amend what I had said earlier, because I don't walk around with papers telling me when my parents travel. They were escaping.
But you know what might
they were
have
escaping
happened,
high
actually?
Taxes. They were escaping high taxes in New York, and so they went to Worcester, Massachusetts, to Taxachusetts.
We know how that goes. You want to escape the taxes. I was going to say maybe they actually just ran into Eichmann in Buenos Aires.
I got news for you. Kristallnacht, 1938. No, of course, ladies. I've been fibbing, folks. I got my story confused with Marco Rubio's story, if that's even his name.
I want to be clear here, folks, that I do enjoy joking around with Sam. But and by the way, I am incredibly stupid. But I was actually thinking more of World War II. To have people think I don't know when Kristallnacht happened would upset me.
I didn't know when it was. Yeah, I thought
it was 39. Well, I wouldn't tell you I knew the month or the day or the perhaps even the year, but I did know, obviously, it was the late 30s. It was pre-actual World War II breaking out. So, at least with us, pre our involvement in World War II.
All I can say is, if you're a member of this program, please, I know that many of you joined because of my story about escaping the pogroms, and some of you joined because of my story about escaping the Nazis. And then others, because I was trying to get a better income tax rate when I was two, moving to Massachusetts. Please, just forget. Can we just forget this whole episode? I mean, isn't that what Marco Rubio is going to say?
Well, if that's really his name, my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, is a huge conservative Republican. And as you can say, we probably have some debates. And we pointed out before that he looks so much like Marco Rubio, it's scary. So I think it may be kind of, there may be a Marco Rubio-type clone factory somewhere that just spits out Republicans.
We should update people on this story, because I think this is an unbelievable story on so many different levels. Marco Rubio has been saying in public, since essentially he's been in public. In fact, the Washington Post has this blockbuster story written by a guy who's been working on his biography, on Marco Rubio's biography, and came across all sorts of documents that have put to lie the narrative that Marco Rubio has been presenting to Floridians and I guess the nation, you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, this is the, it is on his website. I mean, it's on his Senate official biography. The second sentence of his official biography in the Senate says that his parents, Mario and Arales Rubio, came to America following Fidel Castro's takeover. Now, Fidel Castro came to power in
1959. I'm going to have to show people the whole rest of the show that I actually know some things now.
Right, exactly. Well, he came to power in 1959. Now, understand, in 1959, when Fidel Castro came to power, let's close that window if we can, or at least put the curtain back. When he came to power in 1959, people in Castro, in Cuba, there was not a mass exodus at that point because there was still an assumption by the elite in Cuba that this guy was – there was no real belief that he was going to nationalize
everything. Going to be that radical. In fact, Sam, it's important to note that many people have argued that it was our CIA – and this has no connection to anything we do today, by the way. None at all. It was just back then. But it was our CIA who just immediately assumed he was on the opposite side of things and even pushed him by targeting him. He needed a sponsor, and that ended up becoming the Soviet Union because obviously he needs somebody to get his back. And that the truth is that he may not have been that revolutionary. We may have pushed him into that corner.
Right.
That's been made by historians, by scholars, that argument.
Right.
So let's
and,
be clear.
And that would be even more relevant if it wasn't for the fact that it appears that Marco Rubio's parents showed up in the United States, left Cuba in 1956. So so the idea that they were fleeing Castro, who I believe in 1956 was living in New York. Now, I may have my dates a little bit off, but I don't even believe that he was in Cuba at that time.
Well, no, I think actually as part of their project to build up the oil wells in the Soviet Union, the Koch brothers had sent them over there to work on some of those projects.
Yes.
To help, if I'm correct. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but, you know.
So, I mean, this is unbelievable. Rubio, so that's his official biography on the Senate website. In 2006, before he became the Speaker of the Florida House, Rubio told an audience, quote, "In January of 1959, a thug named Fidel Castro took power in Cuba, and countless Cubans were forced to flee and come here, many, most here to America. When they arrived, they were welcomed by the most compassionate people on earth." And he, in referencing his parents, they were from Cuba. They wanted to live. So you have a guy here who has built his entire political career, because, of course, in Florida, there are many Cuban exiles, some who left to escape Castro, but some who, like his family, came here, like countless immigrants before his family, and including his family, apparently, simply to have a better economic life.
In fact, my grandfather did run away from the pogroms that you referred to before. That's how I knew about when that stuff was going on, and came here in 1906 for that very reason, because they weren't big fans of his over in the what would be the Ukraine now.
But that story is even different, because they're fleeing oppression, as opposed to simply, we want to better our lives. Now, in 1956, it turns out Castro is in Mexico. Is in Mexico at that time. So the idea that Marco Rubio, this is a threefer as far as I'm concerned. And I have to say that the best tweet I've seen on this comes from Jameson Foer, who wrote, "This in no way will inhibit Marco Rubio's chance to become a vice president if it's Mitt Romney." Let me read the tweet, because he did it. He said, "Not sure the Washington Post article kills Rubio's VP chances. Romney might like a guy who isn't committed to his actual past."
Nicely done. Famous imposer of Media Matters?
I don't know if he's still at Media Matters. But
he used to be. Yeah,
exactly. And,
good dude.
And so you have a guy who, A, has lied to the people of Florida, and I guess arguably to the nation, by trying to get credit as being a classic, exile.
He had to run because of oppression, and that's how he learned to value the importance of democracy and the free markets and blah, 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 you know, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit.
And on top of that, though, here's a guy who has been, maybe it's wrong to say virulently anti-immigrant, but has essentially lifted the, pulled up the ladder. His parents came looking for a better life, not escaping political oppression, not because they're the ill-begotten gains of the Batista regime provided them a factory that was nationalized by Castro. No, they came here like many, many other immigrants continue to come to this country to find a better economic life. And so he has, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is really not dramatically different than, your Ed Schrock here. A closet case who goes on to bash gays.
Calling it on some fun gay porn phone numbers. Exactly.
And now he's going around saying, well, I didn't know the details. Well, he certainly didn't have any problem expressing the details on his official biography on the Senate.
It was what is known in Republican Party circles as not intended to be a factual statement.
That's right.
As we know, it's exactly that. You can be like John Kyle and say, oh my God, they're 114% of what they do at Planned Parenthood is abortion, or 3%. That's kind of the world we live in. It's a good sort of synopsis of the political culture that we exist in. But these guys know they can say anything because, first of all, half the time, nobody even calls them on it. Second of all, when they do get called on it, it tends to often end up in a he said, she said. So good. The Washington Post, I haven't read the story, but hopefully did a good job of pointing out how full of crap he was. But then it'll end up on some shows. My guess is, your Heritage Foundation hack will show up and say, oh, but, I can't think of his name right now, from Connecticut, lied about his Vietnam, war record. And they'll find Democrats who lied about some things, too, even though, in the end, if you looked at who these people are who lie about virtually everything, you find yourself about 9 Republicans for every 1 Democrat. But they'll find those Democrats, because they exist, who have also lied about things, and then they'll try to make it like all sides do it. It's not, it doesn't matter at all, and the media won't call them on it because it's a he said, she said media, and the right-wing media will pound on anybody who tries to tell the story. And it'll end up where it ends up, these things, And that's pretty much it, unless there's a gay sex scandal.
Unless
you're Larry Craig tapping someone's foot in the bathroom, you're probably going to be okay.
Listen, I disagree with you on this, and I'll tell you why. Because
I hope you're right.
I'll tell you why. Because I think this is going to resonate, I think, in the Latino community in a different way. It's not simply a story of a guy who's lying to embellish his past. Okay, and I imagine that if you look at Blumenthal, I'm not even sure that he frankly embellished in the way that Rubio is here. But let's pretend for a moment that we are the Meet the Press guy for a minute. David, what's
the guy that Bush used to call Stretch? Let's just call him Stretch.
Okay, let's assume for a moment that we're Stretch. Okay, it's two examples of embellishment. This isn't going to hurt Marco Rubio. I imagine that Blumenthal didn't do so well with a group of Vietnam vets. And I think this story is going to have much more resonance in the Latino community than it will inside the Beltway or even outside the Beltway. And
you're a smart dude, Sam. You the thing about you is that you've never, as far as I know, been a political strategist on the ground. This is why you're smarter than the entire Democratic Party apparatus, or let's see, but you probably are. If they wanted to do something with this, you're exactly right. That is what they would do. It's kind of like if somebody had done what you did and claim that they left because the Nazis, but they didn't. It's the Jewish community where you'd want to make you pay the price for that lie, your own community. So when you get up in front of your own community, they're booing you, and you have to answer questions about why you pick a terrible point out of history, and use that. Well, I'm not saying it's quite the Holocaust, but Fidel Castro taking over for many Cubans is obviously is a terrible, traumatic moment.
Right.
The truth is, what if they were smart, they they'd have Spanish language advertisements up literally in no time in the Southwest, in part in Florida, obviously, and some other places, reminding people that this guy used a genuine tragedy. And I'm not saying that who came before Castro was good, Batista was a murderer, but I'm just saying Castro eventually ended up becoming one, and that they, that this guy was willing to play on that, to play on whatever suffering they've gone through, because of to further his political career. That's what they would do.
And I'll tell you something. Even his explanation now, you know, as he's trying to sort of wiggle out of this, he confirmed his office confirmed yesterday that his parents arrived in the United States in 1956, but noted that, quote, while they were prepared to live here permanently. Okay, this is he's trying to play both sides of the fence here. No pun intended. While they're prepared to live here permanently, speaking of the United States, they always held out the hope and the option of returning to Cuba if things improved. They returned to Cuba several times after Castro came into power to assess the situation with the hope of eventually moving back. Now, so they came here not because of Castro. They wanted to live here permanently because apparently this is the land of the home and the brave, you know, the brave and a free market, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there was a free market, and maybe even more with Batista, maybe even more identical to the one that we have today, frankly, than the one that we sort of romantically imagine. So they were going to stay in America permanently, but they always held out hope that they could go back. I mean, isn't that the classic story of every immigrant? And it's the story that he shunned because he did not want to throw himself amongst, he did not want to count himself as one of those people.
Well, that wasn't good enough for him.
Right.
That wasn't good enough for him. He has to become the crusader, the guy, you know, he has to broaden his place in history. That his family were the ones objecting to him. And again, it's the way to sort of position him as, my entire life, you know, we were affected by communism and we realized the beauty of free markets and we came here to live that life because of the communists who took over. I mean, you know, it's not good enough to just give a normal story, which actually is a pretty compelling story on its own. It's just he has to give a bullshit narrative to sort of broaden his place in history. And but I will. I do have to say one thing. I think you're not being fair about, which is it's a little known and overlooked fact that right before about in 1956, Batista started ignoring the FISA laws. Rubio's family was friends with him, and they were able to listen in on Castro's phone calls.
That's right.
So they knew that Castro was going to take over at some point. So I think Sam, you're being a little bit unfair.
Oh, I think everybody would have bet that when Castro was trying to organize a couple hundred people in Mexico to come in and march through the jungle, everybody thought this guy was going to take over. That was the most noble thing in the world.
I mean, you may remember Michael Corleone figured it out, but you know what? Fredo didn't know. And neither did the rest of the crew there. Mo Green died in the first one, but the rest of those guys, they didn't figure it out. So look at how Michael had to escape in the dark of night, you know, out of Cuba as Castro was taking over. And look at how they lost all the interest they had in all the casinos there. I mean, that's an important thing. If Michael Corleone didn't know, nobody knew.
I can't wait for Rubio to talk about that boat ride. That Michael, you know, sent Fredo on, and sort of work himself into that narrative. That'll be fun. I mean, I agree with you that within the Washington Beltway establishment, they'll just say he's just another guy who's, you know, he's just sort of a little liar. And when they start taking polling, when Flip Romney wants to decide who he's going to choose as a vice president, I think Rubio is not going to be on that list anymore because they're going to start
if it's done right, I think what you and I both said is not mutually exclusive, which is the D.C., the Beltway media is going to yawn and not care. But when they start to care is when they think something, you know, is important and cool is going on and they've got a good talking point for their cocktail party. So, you know, when it may become something is, as you know, as I was saying, and you were talking about it happening in his community, if progressives, whether it's independent groups, super PACs, Democratic Party organizations, whoever, they were smart, to get up on TV and radio and lambast this guy and point out how he literally has used some of the tragedies of his own community to further his political career, and he's a liar. And they would undercut him among his own ostensible base. And then he literally would become worthless. Not only would become worthless to the Republicans, but also that's when the Beltway starts to take paying attention. It's kind of like when Barack Obama's numbers go down among African Americans, then they suddenly care. You know what I mean? If Rubio's numbers are going to start to go down among the Hispanic community, then they've got an intra-ethnic group warfare story, and they love conflict. You know what I mean? Then it becomes a fun story for them.
Yeah, and so, I think the one truism that I have come to understand in this country is that the capacity for the Beltway and the establishment media in this country to understand what is going on in the Latino community is about nil. You know, like, you know, we all of a sudden, as far as the corporate media is concerned, it's like, oh my God, how are there hundreds of thousands of Latinos marching against immigration policies?
Where did they come from? It's pretty much akin to their understanding of what the important issues are among the Ewok community.
And you know,
I didn't get a laugh out of you on that one, Sam.
What? Well, you know, I was just looking at a story. I guess back in 2010, Rubio had another problem with charging on an American Express card that he got from the Republican Party. He charged a lot of his own personal stuff. Now, you know, it's one of those things like, I don't walk around with the billing records of my American Express for 3 years. It didn't even occur to me that I wasn't getting the bills. You know, this guy, there's a pattern here. And I think this is really going to sink him, but, let's move on because I also, you're from Ohio and there's nothing I love more than a good story about how you may be eaten by a tiger in Ohio. Isn't that why your family fled the Congo?
I grew up in New York City, and my family fled to Ohio because we were looking for the opportunity to have feces flung at us by an escaped monkey.
I always thought on the Libertas LLC bio page, I seem to recall it was something like my family left New York for fear that the lions from the circus would escape that trek through the Lincoln Tunnel and would have attacked us.
And sort of the unending persecution of progressive Jews in New York City.
Yes.
That's running. And
you went to Ohio.
And then we come out here and we try to start a new life for ourselves out on the frontier, if you will.
To find a good bagel.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're searching for good bagels everywhere. You know, we're living the life of, we're living the Republican American dream, you know, frontiers people out on our own, risking, fighting the Native Americans wherever we can, which in this part of the country tend to be overweight white guys who are about 85 years old and on respirators while eating large donuts. I kid. Ohio's a wonderful place. Yeah, well, again, this jackass in eastern, an hour east of Columbus, had this exotic farm, and which this will shock you because, as you know, with Senate Bill 5, John Kasich has been right on the ball with that one and hasn't found himself in a 20-point hole after his dumbass assault on collective bargaining. But when he came into office, there was the expiration of this executive order on how exotic animals should be held and treated and in the state. And he said it would hurt small businesses to regulate that. So some crazy dude living out in an hour east of Columbus who had been arrested and spent time in prison for illegal firearms possession and also, what do you know, had been cited for abusing animals, was allowed to have 56 exotic animals running around his farm without any government knowledge of what he was doing. Because the Ohio Department of Natural Resources was not actually given the ability, once the executive order was gone, to even track this guy's farm and what the hell was going on.
Well, let me say one thing, okay? That is because Americans don't like their freedom encroached upon. If you don't have the right to have tens of literally scores of exotic animals and create your own little zoo, our freedom is being encroached upon it. And
that's a good point.
I think if you read your Federalist Papers, I'm You'll sure see one that, of those that, guys.
I think it was Federalist number 10 where James Madison referred to the freedom to be ripped limb from limb by a black bear.
Right. Yes.
I'm correct. that's what happened. And just the terrible thing about it is, look, I'm not going to judge. I know I'm an animal lover myself, and it's hard to know, did the animals need to be, could they just have been, I'm not finding the right word, but you know what I'm looking for.
They get shot with a tranquilizer.
Tranquilizer, thank you. Or, you know, did they have to be killed? I know some people have said on both sides, and I don't know enough. I just know that this situation would have never, ever happened if an asshole who had illegal firearms and was cited for abusing animals had animals taken away from him, because we hadn't gone through 40 years of allowing right-wing cranks to define regulation as a bad thing, kind of like regulation of Wall Street is a bad thing. Let's get rid of Glass-Steagall. What could go wrong? This is no different than that. This is part of a broader story of, you know, so many things we're seeing out there right now. You know, a friend of yours and mine, in fact, you do a radio show with him, Mike Papatonio, we just saw it when we were in Las Vegas, is now working on this big case of the, you know, birth control pill Yaz that's poisoning people and poisoning women, and it's called embolisms. And they found that women are 630% more likely to get an embolism when they take this. But, of course, this drug company was able to obfuscate, and there's no real regulation. They were able to spend 10 times as much on marketing as on testing the pill. And now women across the country are suffering. I just wrote a column that kind of included all three of these examples because they're all so different, and yet they're all the same.
You know what I mean? You're absolutely right. And, you know, there was a great piece in the Washington Post this week by a guy named Robert Adler, who is one of the commissioners on the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And he makes a great point, which dovetails with what you're saying. It dovetails, frankly, with what guys like Papantonio do. The thing that people forget in terms of safety regulations or any type of regulations, because it could have been the case with these animals, is that that regulations do not add cost to anybody. What regulations do is they reallocate the costs. So, for instance, in the scenario of the animals, the real risk that was being born here or carried here was not by that guy who had those animals. He had some risk. But in fact, anybody who lived within the roaming distance of a Bengal tiger or whatever it was also bearing this risk, because they could get themselves ripped apart. They could lose an arm. They could die. Whatever it was, they were assuming some of this guy's risk. And so when you talk about safety regulations on, we shouldn't have certain products in our food, we shouldn't have corporations should have certain responsibilities not to pollute, it's not a question of these regulations are going to create more expense. It is that the expense is going to be bared by the person who is incurring them. And so, people were complaining about Bank of America adding $5 onto the debit card fee. Well, that is a misinterpretation of what was going on. We were all, whether you use the debit card or not, paying for that fee. It was just shifted to the people who were actually using their debit cards. Now, you can argue that Bank of America is making off like a bandit because they're actually charging more than it costs them to use this debit card. But the fact of the matter is, at least it provided some transparency. This is the fundamental problem we have in the argument with regulations, whether it's about those animals, whether it's about Yaz, that pill. Because, look, it's either Bayer is going to pay the cost of putting out an unsafe product, or the people who take that product are going to bear the cost. And so it's really just a shifting. It's a reallocation of who bears the risk. And it should be the people who are profiting or are exercising a benefit from whatever they're doing that should bear the expense of that risk, as opposed to unsuspecting workers, consumers, neighbors in the case of Ohio. That's the point.
No, that's exactly right. And I mean, the fact that you just made that passionate and eloquent argument that it seems that most Democrats don't know how to make. And again, when you and I have been so upset with the Obama administration at times, and it's not even just them, so many Democrats I'm upset with, you know, on this, which is, the progressive argument, it really isn't all that difficult. I mean, if in the end, if you just watched Wall Street explode, if Enron wasn't that many years ago, if other, you know, and there's probably half a gazillion other cases of missing. Oh, if money's being lost in frickin' Iraq and Afghanistan in the multi-millions and billions because Blackwater and friends aren't regulated, this is not a difficult argument to make. That regulation is needed and regulation is necessary. Yeah, not over-regulation, not ridiculous stuff. Nobody's arguing for that. But necessary regulations are what, in an advanced economy like ours, lets all of us know the other guy is playing by certain rules and is up to a certain quality. I mean, what they don't ever talk about is how much it hurts business when there aren't regulations. Because am I going to trust somebody when I don't trust any regulations on them for their product? Am I gonna add that product to my business if that's potentially what I do? Of course not. I mean, not if I have any common sense. So and then the greater cost once there's a big crash like Wall Street. Geez, what did that cost all of us? Slightly more than the regulation would have, just a little bit. So it just is. It's infuriating. It's infuriating that this argument wasn't made the minute Obama got in by all Democrats of all stripes, that the necessary need after 30 years of this binge of deregulation to re-regulate our economy in an intelligent way.
Well, I mean, first off, you make a fantastic point. I mean, I would love to see how a libertarian responds to the idea, okay, you don't like regulation? Let's get rid of all regulation. Let's make it very explicit. You want a free market? Let's have a free flow of information. Stiglitz won his Nobel Prize on the asymmetry of market information. Let's make a big campaign where every single consumer knows that when you go buy your food, when you go buy your meat, it has not been inspected by anybody. When you go buy your kids some candy, There's no regulations as to whether or not there can be lead, arsenic, any type of poison in there. It's just roll the dice and see what happens to the economy.
Thing. All of us who have kids, I mean, when you buy these toys, are you as scared shitless as I tend to be?
Of course.
And
if there was an announcement that, hey, you know what? The Consumer Product Safety Commission, the FDA, we're done. We're closing up shop. Good luck. Eventually, you'll find out what product doesn't kill your kid. Just, you got to have a lot of kids.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like the old days. If you have enough of them and a few of them die, then, your seed will still pass on.
Right. I mean, that's the plan, right? You have 9 kids, and maybe in the end, you'll have 2 that you have to pay for college.
Yeah. It actually seems like a pretty good plan. I like it. But that's it. I mean, in the end, and it's real shit, because my kids, for a while there, my older son was into the whole Thomas thing. We're buying this stuff, and a bunch of that crap got recalled from China because it had lead in it.
Yep.
Can I watch my 3-year-old every freaking second to make sure he didn't put this crap in his mouth? Should I have to? In an advanced, wealthy country like we are, is that what I should have to do? Is that worth it? Is that worth the outsourcing of the jobs and the cheap crap at Walmart? I mean, not to me. I'd rather pay a little more money and make sure my kid lives through the experience, or at least his IQ is still intact when he's done.
And if you want to be crass about it, look at from a societal standpoint, for every moment that you're sitting there having to monitor what your kid is doing, you're just not being productive.
But you need to look at it that way because that's the way the right looks at it.
Right.
They look at everything in economic terms. So, if we're not going to even look at it in compassionate terms because we know they don't know what that is, if we look at it in economic terms, what is being lost by that? What is being lost in my time where I've got a small business that employs people? What's being lost in terms of my productivity? What's being lost if my child is made sick and then guess where he ends up? If he ends up in the emergency room or somewhere where guess who pays for it? All of us.
Right.
It makes no sense on any level. It's just stupid, and that's how you know it's not conservative economics. It's crony economics. That's all it is.
That's right, and I think therein may lie the answer as to why President Obama didn't make that case in terms of Wall Street. But be that as it may, let's just move on. I want to touch on this one thing, and then we're going over today, folks. You're welcome. Huge bonus. Speaking of a lack of productivity and financial difficulties.
Damn, I mean, you're killing the economy.
I'm killing my own personal economy. But but let's talk about this jobs bill, because there was a part of President Obama's proposed jobs bill, and you and I would consider it anemic, but every little bit helps at this point. You had a jobs bill which offered up about $40 billion, I think it was, in direct infrastructure, or I should say jobs, frankly, in terms of like hiring, I think, 400,000 new teachers, about 20,000 new cops, and another 10 or 20,000 new firefighters, somewhere in those neighborhoods. Let's just call it 400,000. And it would have required to pay for it. It was a $35 billion in state aid, first responders and teachers. It would have required a 0.5% surtax on every dollar after a million that a millionaire makes.
That's
so
crazy.
In other words,
if crazy you, talk.
If you make $1 million, you would pay no more in tax. If you made, let's say, $1,100,000, you would pay an extra 50 cents, right? Half a percentage point of 100 is 50 cents in tax. And so this was shot down in the Senate. 48 Republicans blocking it. Nelson and Tester, whose name I can barely even say without spitting at this point.
Which one or both?
Well, Nelson is Nelson. Tester, I feel, is a genuine betrayal. But
he was at one point ran as a populist and now acts like an imbecile.
That's not the story. There was a 51-50 in favor, because if it was a real vote, the vice president would have come down and voted, would have voted in favor, obviously, for the jobs bill. So we have a situation in this country now where a jobs bill with overwhelming popular support is killed, not just in the Senate, but by the Republicans in the Senate. How dysfunctional are our politics now that they feel they can get away with this and that this actually happens?
I mean, again, as dysfunctional as you and I have discussed, they don't feel like that there's any, you know, they've done their 30-year project. They've created their own right-wing pipeline of media to reach the people they care to reach. The mainstream media is still important, has an influence, but because of the sort of he said, she said, what's going on, who's the doctor that killed Michael Jackson, let's get him on TV all day, bullshit that goes on, that there's not nearly enough coverage of this kind of stuff, this kind of betrayal and what's going on, and they know that too. And when you add all that up, they've corrupted academia, you know, the Koch brothers have put in, you know, think tanks at all sorts of places. I can't remember the name of the college in Florida, but at George Mason or whatever, to corrupt academia so that you've got bullshit studies coming out of these places. Obviously, the Heritage Foundation, America Enterprise Institute, and others pump out crap, lying about this kind of stuff. The irony is that these are the guys yelling about, relativism and things like that 30 years ago and, you know, postmodernism and everything. But they're the ones now who really don't believe there is any truth. If they can create doubt, that's what they do with everything, man. They do that with the gun issue that I work on so much. They do that when it comes to global warming, when they do that. That was the model they learned from the tobacco industry, you know, which allowed these guys to keep poisoning people for an additional 40 years beyond when they should have, and lying about it. I mean, that's what they do, you know, and it's terrible. But that's they know that there aren't repercussions, because in the end, and I wrote an article a bunch of years ago for the Washington Monthly on Mitch McConnell, and he routinely would not get the endorsements of the newspapers, and you know, in Kentucky, and he'd get ripped, you know, here and there on TV stations. But he knew that for every time he got ripped on a TV station, and every editorial came out, blasting him, he would raise gazillions from corporate America and be all over TV telling everybody how wonderful he is, which would easily outweigh the negative impact. So in the end, until you get the corporate money out of this, out of our system, and it's the only actually obviously gotten worse since then, with this ridiculous, Idiots United decision, that's the only answer. I mean, there may be other answers. I mean, I guess create independent media, do what you're doing, do the thing that I'm going to be doing in Washington, D.C., you know, current TV. I mean, there are other ways we try, and I think we've had an impact. Blogs have been terrific, and so I'm not saying there's no way to fight back, but obviously the big goal that still has to be to get the corporate money out of it, because as long as these guys can go on TV and spend untold sums of money telling lies about themselves and claiming they actually care about regular people and portraying themselves as much differently than they are, and no one can call them on it 24 hours a day, we're all in a lot of fucking trouble.
And frankly, I mean, that's why, you know, I've been dedicating and I'm so excited, frankly, to what's happening with Occupy Wall Street. I mean, hopefully that when we talk about, you know, what the goals or the agenda of what's happening there, I think that's one of the undisputed and primary goals of what's happening down there is to sort of return our politics to some level of sanity so that at the very least we can actually have an honest debate about what's going on in our politics. And we can't now because corporate money has corrupted it. You're absolutely right. Cliff, as always, a pleasure. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back with our songs of the week. But Cliff, as always, and we'll speak to you next week.
I look forward to it, man. Thanks a lot.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with our songs. I don't know if we have Chris Rosen today. He's not responding to my IMs anymore. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Still trying to get Victoria Jackson to be our new film reviewer. We're efforting that, as they say, in the business. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll play our songs, and I think in just a matter of moments, we're going to have a special guest in studio. I don't want to hype it too much, but all right, we'll be right back after this.
Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
A girl!
Let's drill, baby, drill, not stall, baby, stall.
That woman is an idiot.
Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him,
we didn't want a garden variety politician taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Right. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
First up for today, our first song of the week from Jimmy Reefer Cake. Happy Friday, Sammy, he writes. This one's straight from my heart. I'm angry and sad about this synthetic drug called bath salts. It is, I guess, sort of like a meth cocaine type of, I'm not sure. I don't know much about it. I haven't read it. Take the fact that almost everyone agrees this drug should be illegal, combine it with the fact that 50% of people support legalizing reefer, that pretty much blows up the hypocrisy meter and does well to sum up the spirits of the Occupy movement. And he also mentions that 538, the Nate Silver blog reports at New York Times, that Gallup is the first poll to find a plurality support for marijuana legalization. This is called the 99% by, of course, Jimmy Reefer Cake.
We got ourselves a problem in the great state of Maine.
There's a drug called bath salts. It's totally insane. It's sold in store, and everyone knows they can kill. It's like crystal meth and LSD, and it's making people ill. Government officials say they got their hands tied, 'cause corporations made them lie. Those sons of bitches in their suits and their ties would scarcely dare to look a hippie kid in the eye. We are, yeah. We are the 99%. They outlaw weed. It's natural. That serves them well. Bath salts ain't the only poison corporations sell. They got synthetic vaginas, pills to make your cock swell. Those 1% are all going straight to hell. We are the 99. Yeah, we are 99%. We are the 99%.
Where's my Jimmy Reefer Cake? Extending the message of the 99%. We'll put up a link to both those links that Jimmy sent around as a that were the inspiration for his song. And now, of course, it is time for David Bejoia and the entire gang, Dan Killian. Oh, I hope some people got to Arlene's Grocery last week. The Screaming Majority, the Bigotry Boomerang. Any visitor to our Facebook page with too much time on his hands can tell you the Screaming Majority's sole brand interest is goofing on shit. So naturally, we're thrilled with the rise of Herman Cain. In about 2 seconds, I came up with it's hard to determine if Herman is German with all of his 999. But Dan said, if we write a Herman Cain song, it's got to be like we're into him. And I'm like, we are into him, you know, goofing on shit. And he's all, no, into him like we want him to be president. And here we see the difference between Dan and me. He's a satirist, but I a lonely jester. These guys, it's like Paul and John, isn't it? Wasn't that like Bejoia is sort of like, the Paul McCartney, and Dan is like John Lennon. P.S. My band, Admiral Porkbrain, will play the music of the late Captain Beefheart at 10:30 Saturday night at Freddy's Bar in Brooklyn. We're very good, I'm told. Sadly, I will not be in time. Let's hear Bigotry Boomerang.
Gather round to your peers and sing in harmony. I got a brand new anti-Romany. He's bringing something new to the table. Victory. 999. Nothing succeeds
are back, ladies and gentlemen. So there you have it. Let's give it one of these. Hold on 1 second. There you go. There you go. The bigotry boomerang. Herman Cain apparently came out, had a great interview about gay people. You know, it's just, you choose it. Which is pretty stunning. It's pretty stunning that you could be saying this in this day and age. But, you know, look, let's be honest. Herman Cain was running essentially to sell some books, and then he subsequently found out that he could possibly win, and now he's being used as a stalking horse to make sure that Rick Perry doesn't get any juice. All right, folks, we don't have Chris Rosen today. And hold on, wait a second. I'm getting an IM from him. Hold on. All right, maybe we'll have Chris Rosen in the post show. We'll try and give him a call. All right, let's go to the better half of the program. Ladies and gentlemen, I made a you've gotten now, as a free show, you've gotten a full almost hour of material. Again, bad business manning on my part, because it doesn't convince you to become a member. You're getting too much material. So please. Oh, and don't forget the podcast awards. Go to podcastawards.com. You can vote for us every day. You simply need to vote for us for People's Choice or News and Politics. And when you vote, they're going to send you an email, and you need to confirm your email address. So please do that. Please become a member. JustCopy.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. And buy your crap through our Amazon link. We'll be back on Monday. Ari Berman, who's got a great story about austerity. We'll be back in the better half of the show in just a brief moment. We'll be right back after this.